Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, and I'm here again with Russ Chianelli this week. And this week, we've got a slightly different program. You know, the regular listener knows that we normally talk to someone active in science, someone that's in oceanography or in space exploration or maybe material science. Today, we're going to talk about how we can take that science, and we've done this before, and perhaps create new companies. How we can create entrepreneurs, how we can take people like me that know a lot of science and nothing about business and all of a sudden say, well, why don't you try this? Why don't you try that? Well, of course, Russell's a little bit of an expert on this, but we have a real expert today. Her name is Rosemary Truman. She is the founder and CEO of an organization called the Center for Advancing Innovation. And Rosemary, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Absolutely. Now, before we get on to, you know, how you're going to make, say, the University of Texas at X, El Paso in this case, be more cognizant of their ability to go out and be creative, innovative, and make money, because I understand that's the bottom line here. Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did Rosemary get to be the founder of a company like this? So when you were 4, 5, 6, what were the driving forces got you to 16 and 26?
Well, when I was 4, there were 6 kids in my family, and my father taught at Harvard. He was a professor of physics. He also built the first rocket propulsion engine, and he also taught me how to blow things up when I was 4. Unfortunately, he died, so there were 6 kids in our family. And
not in an explosion.
Like not an explosion. Okay. It was unfortunately cancer. So my mom, you know, with the first green screen computer, went to the library and found out that if you move to West Virginia – with a master's degree, you can become a teacher without any teaching background. And so, therefore, she could sell the brownstone in Cambridge and buy a house outright in West Virginia and move us all there. So my father was certainly an inspiration. He used to bring home his papers and give me the set of encyclopedias and say, look up all the words. He taught me how to read when I was 3. And I tortured him so significantly, you know, with books, making him read me books upon books upon books and about science and math and all kinds of things. So when we moved to West Virginia, you know, I continued my desire and learning without him. But really, what I really wanted to do was make money. I really just wanted to make money because we grew up very poor. So that's how I came to where I was. So, my mom's rule was you go to an Ivy League school, you get a full scholarship.
When you mean poor, I mean, what did you actually have to worry about, food or?
Well, I didn't
give
get
an example.
Oh, I'll give you an example. Yeah. My brother used to get 2 pieces of chicken and I would only get 1. Why is that?
well, that's sexism. I don't think that's got much to do with income.
Yeah, that's true. But we had a very large garden, and sometimes actually it was food was an issue sometimes.
So anyway, your mother was quite a visionary. I mean, I like this idea of finding where you could actually be a good teacher without having to go through the education department. That's, I think, very creative.
Yes, very creative.
And then says to you, the daughter, and presumably your siblings.
Oh, all of us.
Yeah.
That was the rule.
You're going to go to an Ivy League school, and then, sweetheart, you're on your own.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
Okay. So you went to Smith, I think, right?
I went to Smith. I went to Princeton. I went to Smith. I got 3 degrees, math, economics, and industrial engineering and operations research.
Let's stop there for 1 minute because that's interesting in itself. 3 degrees in 4 years, mm-hmm. You know, that, and one of them is in math, one's in engineering, and then the other is in business. So in a sense, this institution, that would be 3 different colleges.
Yes.
And each college, this sort of a state institution, has its own little prerequisites. Mm-hmm. That means you couldn't do this in 4 years at a state school.
Theoretically, yeah.
Yeah, but a private school has got that capacity flexibility.
Because there was no core curriculum.
Right.
So I didn't, in high school, I took all of the, what's normally called the core curriculum in a state school. So I didn't have to take any of that. So I could just hyper-accelerate.
So you're a real interdisciplinarian.
Yes.
And so after Smith, then you had these 3 degrees.
So
you wanted to make money.
This is a very, very funny story, actually.
Good.
So I wanted to either work for McKinsey or Goldman Sachs. So I got the list of all the alumni that could get me into McKinsey or Goldman Sachs. At that time, they would only take MBAs. Now, I had gotten also a master's in econometrics at Smith, but obviously that's not an MBA. I mean, they wanted a full MBA, two-year MBA. So I wrote to the alumni my senior year. Every week I had a different alumni. I would follow up with them with all these letters. And I finally wrote a proposal to Goldman. So I figured out that they were losing about $60 million a year in errors on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. So what would happen is the guys on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange used to go into the crowd and say, brrr, and they'd go back and they'd have to call the guys up at 85 Broad. So it was all via voice. And a lot of times a trade would go through incorrectly because the actual trade had to be executed at 85 Broad. So
this is an address somewhere in New York.
Yes, yeah. So basically the floor of the New York Stock Exchange is about two blocks from 85 Broad, and Goldman Sachs' office is at 85 Broad, and that's where the trade would be executed. So there'd be a voice call from the floor up to 85 Broad. So I found out they're losing all this money. So I wrote a proposal. I said, you know, if you hire me for $400,000, I will save you $40 million. I thought that was a great deal because, you know, it's 1%. So I wrote it. I socialized it. I basically begged for a job, and then they hired me. They hired me for $42,000. They left off a zero. I don't know how they could have done that.
Well, you just make them one-tenth of what you promised. It's very simple.
I wanted performance-based. I was like, well, did you miss a zero? but they gave me a nice sign-on bonus. It was about 20% of my salary.
So. Oh, that's good. So, in fact, then you talked and wrote and thought your way into the position.
Yep.
And you were at Goldman Sachs for how long?
I was at Goldman Sachs for 2 years. I was on the listed stock block desk. That's a very special area because I was the only analyst on that desk. And, you know, I was like the baby analyst. My job every day was to write what markets are going to move. What markets can we move?
Right.
The listed stock block desk is where Goldman trades for their own book of business and for institutional sales clients. So it's a very important book.
In your training, what was the part of your degrees and background that helped the most? Math, obviously, I know a lot of people.
All
get,
of my degrees,
yeah,
actually.
Right.
I mean, math definitely, and economics.
Okay.
Yeah. And econometrics. I mean, we had to do a lot of modeling.
All
you know,
right.
figuring out, like, which markets could truly, are you going to really get a hockey stick approach, you know, hockey stick effect
right.
on the market? You know, really, where can you make a market? Because Goldman liked to make markets.
So all of the degrees helped.
Yep.
But then the you had to write a thesis, presumably, for the MS in econometrics.
I did.
Was that useful?
Oh, it was very useful. The name of the thesis was Why Do Women Choose Lower Wages? So you can see how maniacal I was about
choose.
Making money.
I like this word, choose.
Choose.
It's their fault.
Yes. I decomposed the wage gap between males and females and women from single-sex schools and women from co-ed schools to see if preferences for job characteristics explain the wage gap more than traditional human capital theories of education and experience. So everybody always thinks it's education and experience are the reasons women earn less. So, of course, my view was women can make as much as they want, you know, because, of course, I'm 6 years old and all I want to do is make money, right? So what we found was that, indeed, 97% of the wage gap is explained by choice, you know, flexible work arrangements, fewer hours, things of that nature, like better area where you're living. You want
right.
to work close to where you live.
And they're all reasonable choices.
They're reasonable choices.
Yes.
And, you know, having babies, that's a reasonable choice. I traveled for 18 years straight. You know, that's – and I don't have any kids, but that's a choice. You know, I made more money because I did consulting for – but I was on the – in an average of 3 countries a week for 5 years.
Well, let's talk about that aspect of the career because clearly the thesis – it was really an entertaining. I just liked the title, this choice business.
Especially at Smith.
Right.
I got high honors for that, by the way.
Did you publish it?
Yes, I published.
Okay,
yeah,
lovely. Yeah. So anyway, you worked there. You're traveling around the world doing what exactly?
So,
consulting at that stage or working for Goldman Sachs?
Yeah, so Goldman, after Goldman, I went into consulting.
Okay.
And strategy consulting. I did actually work at Oracle for a little while. I was hired to do market strategy, and I built their advanced technology group because I just got very, very technical. But after that, I went to consulting.
Okay.
So my specialty is growth strategy and transformation.
Now, to tell the audience who listen to science, growth strategy and what was the other word?
Transformation.
What does that mean?
Okay. So growth strategy, we really think about growth for a company, for corporations, in three ways. One is what we call Horizon One growth. It's a very tactical growth. It's like branding, pricing, marketing, very tactical. There are 11 levers that you always have to look at, but they're tactical. there's what's
called. And this is well accepted. This is everybody understands what you're talking about in the business.
In the business, yes. Right. Well, I mean, people have different views of it, but this is my view, and I have trade secrets on my growth strategy stuff. So when I implement a growth strategy, this is the way I look at it. So Horizon 2 growth is what we call adjacencies. So you, let's say you have a cell phone and you don't have a case for it. The case could be an accessory. That's another thing you can sell. So that's an adjacent market. If you're selling something in the U.S. and you're not selling it in Europe, that's an adjacent market. So these are just expanding your current base of products. It's not anything growth breakthrough.
And this is taken as an accepted model for growth in
yes.
businesses.
Yes.
So, I mean, when I change from an iPhone 4 to 5 to 6, the reason for me having to buy a different charger each time
yep.
is because of people like you saying
exactly.
accessories. You cannot possibly have the same charger
oh, no.
for the older model.
Absolutely. That's
it's a racket.
That's
I don't have a holster for my iPhone. I've been trying to get one. They don't make one yet.
So the most exciting horizon of growth is Horizon 3 growth, and that's making a market. So we have Horizon 1, tactical, Horizon 2, adjacencies. Horizon 3 is making a market. That's what we call a growth breakthrough. That's the hardest kind of growth that you can achieve. And in life sciences, in science, the only way to actually create a new product is to create a growth breakthrough because of things like comparative effectiveness with the FDA. You actually have to have something that's substantially better, that's substantially novel. It's faster, better, cheaper, or they won't approve it.
So, in fact, all of those factors are important.
Yes.
I mean, it's not just that it does something a little bit better.
It's got to be
an awful lot better for industry to come
right.
and put in the investment.
And that's why it's really – in life sciences, I've worked across industries. Life sciences is the most difficult area to actually create a growth breakthrough. It's the most exciting area, in my opinion.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russell Chianelli today and also with Rosemary Truman, the founder and CEO of the Center for Advancing Innovation. She's a fascinating woman, and we'll be back after a short break.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Drug companies spend hundreds of millions of dollars to develop a new antibiotic. We seriously need them as bacteria become increasingly drug resistant.
So imagine finding a new antibiotic in a centuries-old medieval text. The 9th century British tome held an ISAB that not only works, but works against one of today's superbacteria, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus or MRSA.
When translated, the recipe calls for equal parts garlic, onion or leek, minced in a mortar for 2 minutes, and mixed with wine from an historic English vineyard. To this, cow bile salts are dissolved and distilled water added.
The mixture is aged in a brass vessel for 9 days and filtered through a cloth and put into a horn. The salve is applied to the eye with a feather.
Microbiologists follow the recipe precisely and apply them to artificial wounds or on mice. In each of 4 batches made, they were shocked to find the salve killed all but 1 in 1,000 MRSA bacteria.
Though each of the ingredients in the recipe has some antibacterial activity, it's unclear why it's so effective. Researchers theorize that putting these ingredients together allows them to attack the bacteria on multiple fronts.
Another theory is that sitting in the brass vessel allows the potion to undergo chemical reactions that create a new molecule they've yet to identify.
This 1,000-year-old potion was created long before bacteria were even identified. So if you think of the medieval times as those dark ages, evidently it's not so dark.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russell Chianelli, Rosemary Truman for the Center of Advancing Innovation. And fascinating beginning to this program. You've told us some wonderful things about your own persistence, creativity, energy. Tell us what you're doing now in terms of trying to interact with universities, and I know about the National Institutes of Health. Mm-hmm. Tell the audience the relationship that you have as a consultant for NIH and universities.
Absolutely. Well, just a little bit more background on how I got there. I was running IBM's innovation and R&D strategy practice globally. And after about 4 years of being in three countries each week and 40 hours on a plane, I decided to start my own company. And so that is the birth of the Center for Advancing Innovation. So I was still working with major corporations, creating growth strategies and also transformation, running a transformation. It's interesting because my sister, who's in science, developed something, and she said, I don't know how to get this patented. So I called the NIH, and I talked to the head of technology transfer at the NIH, and I said, can I have a half an hour discussion with you? I just want to help my sister figure out how to get this thing she made patented. So I went in, and after a two-hour meeting, they said, we'd really like to hire you to help us figure out how we can make ourselves more relevant to industry. So the NIH has about 18,000 patents. They do about 275 licensing deals a year. A significant portion of those licensing deals, however, are terminated or they are dropped for some reason. So a small portion of the NIH portfolio gets out. So we did a project with them. We came up with five recommendations to figure out, again, how can they make themselves more relevant. And by the way, the NIH is the best across all federal labs at technology transfer. So they're already great. So how can we make them maximize the potential of their portfolio?
Do you understand why they're better than, say, NASA or
yes,
DARPA or all these other agencies?
Yeah. There are several reasons, but there are opportunities. There's opportunities.
That's the key feature.
There are opportunities. So
the country is paranoid about health.
Yes.
And so that's got it.
So we came up with these five recommendations. One of the recommendations was to evaluate this giant portfolio of inventions and figure out which ones can be monetized and actually create a prioritization of the best inventions that can be monetized. So we started that work with the NCI, the National Cancer Institute, because they have about 40% of the portfolio. So we got to the end of that piece of work, and we figured out that they have 50 great inventions that can be commercialized. And they have some inventions that they should release. They should no longer support patent prosecution fees. So we have about 18 agreements across the NIH to do that kind of work, look at their portfolio, figure out how to commercialize it.
Now, this decision as to which ones to discard and which ones to push, this wasn't just Rosemary. This was you plus some experts sitting around the table.
This was a significant due diligence model that we have. It's 158 variables that we look at, devices, diagnostics, therapeutics, vaccines, by indication, so a multidimensional segmentation analysis. It's a very robust due diligence model, and I have about 20 people that work on the due diligence for the portfolio. It's literally a highly objective and mathematical approach. It's not subjective at all.
Okay. Well, so that's a great background, and you've got this sort of mandate from the NIH. What are you doing now at the University of Texas at El Paso?
Yeah, so the background for that is we did a project for the Kauffman Foundation to
The entrepreneurship people in Kansas.
That's right. That's them. And we identified that if we could take all of the portfolios in the United States of the top 150 research institutes and monetize them, we could make a $1.5 trillion GDP impact on the U.S. economy. And the worst-case scenario is a $500 billion impact. We then said, well, how could you mobilize something like that and galvanize the United States to address this $1.5 trillion? Now, meanwhile, we also did a project for the Council on Competitiveness to analyze the innovation arms race of the U.S. versus the rest of the world, and we found the U.S. is losing our leadership position in innovation from 2014 to 2024. So these two factors of having 150,000 inventions on the shelf, $1.5 trillion opportunity, and the fact that we're losing our innovation arms race, we could address the innovation arms race with these patents and this research that's sitting on the shelf.
Let me just make that clear so I understand it, therefore the audience can. The arms race, that's airplanes, bombs, rockets, and all that stuff, tanks.
That's what I understand is the
arms race.
The innovation arms race are things like patents, patent applications, patent grants.
Well, I mean, that brings up an interesting, and maybe this is a little off topic, but I know personally a lot of small companies that have got very creative, innovative people, got very good patents, but somebody wants them somewhere else in the
world. That's right.
They come in, they buy it, they close down the factory or the plant or the research facility here. How do you cope with that one? I mean, it's all very well saying, okay, we're going to do something with these 150 top research institutes and their patents, but other people can come and buy them and export them, repatriate them to somewhere else.
They can.
Yeah.
That's why we need a systematic approach in the United States to take these inventions and create a national commercialization engine. So that was our recommendation to Kauffman. Create a national commercialization engine. Dump those 150,000 inventions into a giant database, analyze them, identify the best ones, and maniacally focus on commercialization of those inventions.
Okay.
So to prevent exactly what you were just talking about. So why am I here at UTEP? I'll tell you why. So we analyzed the U.S. and said, where could we pilot this model and actually make a significant economic impact, and in a way we could hyper-accelerate growth for the economy, but at the same time also drive innovations. So we looked at innovation headroom, you know, where is there headroom, and also economic impact. And so I'm sitting at UTEP right this minute because this is ground zero of what we found, where we could make the most significant impact from an economic development standpoint and also drive innovation.
And that's because innovation is rampant here, obviously, but there's an economic need in this region
of the
country compared to, say, Boston or
prosperity
et
levels need to be increased, workforce mobilization, GDP per capita. So we looked at all of those metrics. We looked at about 30 different metrics to choose very specifically where should we go to pilot this model. So we want to inject 30 new startups here, have them hyper-accelerate, give them escape velocity by driving in some significant funding into these startups. We're plucking out NASA inventions, plugging them into the ecosystem here. These are inventions that already work. Mining the fantastic inventions that are already here. You have 160 inventions sitting at UTEP that we can mine as well. Bolting startups around them, creating an ecosystem, not just a local ecosystem, which is critical. We have to have the local ecosystem here, but also putting together a global ecosystem. So we've actually created this global ecosystem already because we have actually spun out 26 startups out of the NIH through a challenge model.
So do you see then the University of Texas at El Paso in this region, in this sort of big portfolio that you're looking at? You talk about NASA,
yes,
you know, space exploration,
yep,
and the like, and then NIH. These are two sort of legs of a three legged stool,
that's
and what's
right,
the other leg?
The UTEP portfolio.
Okay.
So
whatever it may be.
Yeah. So the inventions we would pull from are the inventions that you already have. Some of them are very mature. NASA inventions, NIH inventions, and we are going to plug them in here, bolt startup teams around them, create the mentoring ecosystem, and then plug in funding to hyper-accelerate their growth. And
do you also have interest in energy?
Absolutely.
So what we're talking about, just to paraphrase a little bit, is there's been some articles about the new Silicon Valley in this region, you know, because we have the opportunity, we have the relation with Mexico, and so it's a really interesting place to do this, and we're very happy that you're here.
Well, tell me, though, you bring up Mexico. What's the big issue that Mexico produces and gives you as a new opportunity?
The opportunity is an amazing workforce, advanced manufacturing that can handle medical device. If I showed you some of the NASA portfolio, like the bionic brain, they could produce that like crazy. But the workforce is incredible here. Plus, you have 100,000 students in this local area. And obviously, part of this is to raise the pool for everyone so that they now have something new on their resume. They're connected to a global ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
So we have people like the head of Pfizer Ventures, Elaine Jones, the head of Novartis Ventures, Reinhard Ambrose. These are people that are part of the ecosystem we've already developed through this challenge model we created with the NIH, the Breast Cancer Startup Challenge, the Neuro Startup Challenge, which we don't have time to go into those today. But
I mean, you obviously see a tremendous opportunity.
I do,
here.
Yes.
So let's – how do you do this now? Now you've identified everything.
Yes.
What's step one, step two, et cetera?
Yes.
What are you now trying to put in place here?
So what we have done a lot of work on is understanding the soil conditions here. You know, what was the environment look like? So we did tours of the university. We look at the resources that the universities have. We look at the people, the inventors that the universities have. We're going to look at the portfolio. So we look at all the resources that the region has to bring to bear. Number one. Number two, we then pull together the portfolios, the invention portfolios. We match them, the portfolio inventions, directly to what the ecosystem can support and really maximize the commercial potential of these inventions. So that's step one. Number one is resource inventory. Step number two, get the inventions, match them to the resource inventory. Step number three is to run a challenge to crowdsource talent from around the world to launch startups around the inventions. So we take the normal business plan competition model and turn it on its head. We say we have 30 inventions. We want to create startups around these inventions. So we put out a giant request for people to come in. We've proven this model.
By come in, you mean buy into the invention.
I think you should explain to the audience the difference between crowdsourcing and some individuals, venture capitalists.
Yeah, we're crowdsourcing teams. We're crowdsourcing teams. So imagine a horse race of 100 people to compete on the basis of one invention. So you're going to get 10 different business plans on this invention. You're going to get 10 live pitches on this invention. You then can pluck the very best team to bolt onto this invention and mentors from around the world.
Oh, that's good.
And so we're going to plant them here, though. They're going to be planted in this region to drive economic growth.
So this is a model that you've used successfully somewhere else.
At NIH, we've proven it twice. We've now spun out.
So the crowdsourcing concept that you have used already with NIH?
Yes.
All right.
We crowdsourced teams from around the world for 26 startups.
So let me get it straight. You crowdsource because you've asked them to send in proposals, or you've asked them to say, what would you do with this invention?
Yeah, well, we also have a huge curriculum. We train them on how to create business plans, how to create...
Yeah, but crowdsourcing at the beginning. Let's say you've got 100 people that respond to Maya Blue.
Yes.
You know, what you can do with this Maya Blue.
Yep.
All right? And then you say, my God, we didn't think of this. This is good. And so you then start to focus on the winners, if you like.
That's right.
And
that's
the
right.
Others... How do you encourage? Do you give a prize for the third, the fourth, or is it you just go out for number one and the others you just drop?
That's a fantastic question. The model is extremely lucrative for the teams that go forward. We've structured a financial model because we carve out equity options. And if they have even a very conservative exit, mm-hmm. they're going to be millionaires.
Okay. And so then if somebody comes in from Bangladesh, mm-hmm. says, oh, this is what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. And now their interest, of course, is creating a facility, jobs in Bangladesh.
Oh, but this is where we have vesting. So obviously the CEO is going to be planted in the El Paso region. In order to get equity, there's vesting. And the vesting period is going to be 10 years. They have to actually be planted in El Paso or they don't get their equity. So they're not going to get the money.
All right. So they have to invest in this region.
Yeah, that's right.
That's part
of the term sheet.
That's the kick.
Yeah, that's
right?
It.
You know, we'll choose you, we'll fund you, we'll push you, we'll train you.
Yep.
But you've got to do this right here.
That's right.
Because that's the first step.
Yep.
Wow. Pretty impressive, Rosemary. I think we've gone through 30 minutes where... Contrary to popular opinion, I've been fascinated by this whole concept of innovation, entrepreneurship, and
it's funny. It's called commercialization.
Well, I know that, but
I
still come back to the fact that I find it scurrilous that just because you buy a new model of an iPhone, you've got to buy a new charger. I find, you know, you might think that
you
is clever business.
Didn't see the picture of the rich kid in China that had his dog with two iPhone watches?
I didn't, but I mean, the point is, and lots of people out there get really angered by that type of business approach. And there's no need for it. One last word for you. This sounds like Bill O'Reilly. I'll give you the last word, Rosemary. Why is that satisfactory?
It's all about making money. It's all about making money.
And it all filters down. Yeah, the trickle theory.
It does. It is.
Okay. Reagan economics all over again. Rosemary Truman, founder and CEO of the Center for Advancing Innovation and a transformative woman, as far as El Paso may be concerned. Thank you so much for being here on Science Studio.
My sincere pleasure.
And come back to Ground Zero when you have a chance.
I will.
The only question I have is, what did your dad teach you to blow up? I blew up stuff when I was a kid, too.
That's the end of another Science Studio. Thank you for listening. We'd like to thank Eddie Rosales for doing the production on the day of the recording, and of course Norma Martinez for the final editing to make it sound so wonderful. We'll be back again next week, and thank you for listening.